From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The investments I'm talking about will create, for the next 20 years, on average, 2 million additional jobs per year. Good-paying jobs. It's transformative.
As President Biden visits his hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania, key parts of his domestic agenda are in jeopardy. From critical climate initiatives to voting rights, due to Republican opposition and resistance from two Senate Democrats, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, who are pushing to radically scale down what was a $3.5 trillion spending bill. We'll speak to Congressmember Ilhan Omar. Then to Egypt to look at the case of imprisoned activist and blogger Ala Abdel Fattah, who spent much of the last decade locked up after playing a prominent role in the peaceful Egyptian revolution of 2011.
It has to be that people are mobilizing not out of desperation, but out of a clear sense that something other than this life of despair is possible.
A new book of Ala's writings has just been released. It's titled, You Have Not Yet Been Defeated. We'll go to Cairo to speak with Ala's mother, Professor Laila Aswef, and Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharifa Gokuduz. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. All 50 Republican senators voted Wednesday to block debate on a federal voting rights bill that would rein in voter suppression laws passed by Republican-led state legislatures. It's the third time Senate Republicans have used the threat of a filibuster to block voting rights legislation. The Freedom to Vote Act was already a compromise that scaled back voter protections under the For the People Act after conservative Democratic Senator Joe Manchin said he would oppose that bill. The latest move by Republicans to stonewall voting rights renewed calls to abolish the Senate filibuster. Senator Manchin Wednesday dismissed a report published by Mother Jones that claimed the West Virginian was considering dropping out of the Democratic Party, calling the report BS, though Manchin used the expletive. On Wednesday, the White House signaled President Biden was removing many of his top legislative priorities from the Build Back Better Act and would offer a massively slimmed-down bill amidst opposition from Republicans and Democratic Senators Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Despite the cuts, President Biden touted his plan during a trip to Scranton, Pennsylvania, on Wednesday.
You all never believed from the beginning that ever get anything done. I think we'll get a deal.
We'll have more on the fight over voting rights and the Build Back Better Act after headlines with Congressmember Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. The Food and Drug Administration Wednesday granted emergency use authorization to booster shots of Moderna and Johnson & Johnson's COVID vaccines. The FDA also approved a mix-and-match strategy for people to get a booster shot that wasn't in their primary series. Meanwhile, the White House Wednesday laid out its plan to vaccinate millions of children between 5 and 11 years old once the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is approved for emergency use in younger children. White House coronavirus Response Coordinator Jeff Zients said the Biden administration is ready to move quickly to distribute children's doses in smaller-sized syringes to pharmacies and pediatricians' offices.
We have more than enough vaccine for every child age 5 through 11. That's 28 million in total. As soon as the vaccine is authorized by the FDA,
the White House anticipates younger children could receive their first shots of Pfizer's COVID vaccine in early November. Here in New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio said Wednesday nearly all municipal workers must get vaccinated against COVID-19 by the end of the month. New York City's police and firefighters unions promised legal action to stop the vaccine mandate. This comes after a viral video showed a pair of New York police officers forcibly ejecting a subway rider from a station after he asked the officers to comply with a city ordinance requiring them to wear masks. NYPD Commissioner Wednesday called the incident absolutely inexcusable and said the two officers would be disciplined. In Chicago, a judge has rejected a bid by the Fraternal Order of Police to temporarily halt Chicago's vaccine mandate. The same judge has ordered Union President John Catanzara to stop talking about the mandate on social media after he urged officers to defy Chicago's vaccination rules.
Do not fill out the portal information. You are under no obligation to do that other than the city's demand. I've made my status very clear as far as the vaccine, but I do not believe the city has the authority to mandate that to anybody, let alone that information about your medical history.
In August, Officer Catanzara came under fire for comparing Chicago's vaccine mandate to the actions of Nazi Germany. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee held a confirmation hearing Wednesday for Rahm Emanuel, President Biden's nominee to become the next U.S. ambassador to Japan. Emanuel served as President Obama's chief of staff and was mayor of Chicago during the police killing of Laquan McDonald, the 17-year-old African-American who was murdered by white police officer Jason Van Dyke in 2014. Rahm Emanuel's nomination drew fire from progressives. Missouri Congresswoman Cori Bush tweeted, quote, "In case you're wondering how much the Senate values black lives, they're holding the confirmation hearing for Rahm Emanuel on the 7-year anniversary of the police's murder of Laquan McDonald, a murder that he helped cover up as mayor. A disgusting disregard for black lives," she tweeted. During Wednesday's hearing, Emanuel stopped short of an apology, but said he was regretful over McDonald's murder.
"I said then, I'm the mayor, and I'm responsible and accountable for fixing this so this never happens again. And to be honest, there's not a day or a week that has gone by in the last 7 years I haven't thought about this and thought about the what-ifs and the changes and what could have been."
In Syria, at least 11 people were killed in a shelling by the Syrian army in Idlib's rebel-held city of Ariha. 4 children and a teacher were reported among the victims. The shelling followed a roadside bomb attack in Damascus, which killed at least 14 military members, according to state TV. Amidst the ongoing conflict, Human Rights Watch is urging countries not to return refugees to a war-torn nation due to ongoing human rights abuses by the Syrian government. This is HRW researcher Sarah Kayali.
People who were stopped at checkpoints, who were kidnapped from their homes, who were subjected to extensive torture and even alleged sexual violence in detention facilities only for returning to Syria. The stories that we heard really showed how the issue of security, the issue of arbitrary detention, and the issue of torture are still front and center in government-held Syria.
The Ethiopian government launched 2 airstrikes in Tigray on Wednesday. Multiple civilians were treated for injuries. The strikes were not the first to hit the northern region this week as the conflict stretches towards one full year. Thousands have been killed and more than 2 million displaced amidst the mounting humanitarian crisis. A federal court has ruled the detainment of a Guantanamo Bay prisoner is unlawful, a week after he was cleared for release by 6 U.S. security agencies. The court granted Asadullah Harun Gul's petition for a writ of habeas corpus. He's the first Guantanamo prisoner in 2 years to win such a case. Asadullah is represented by the group Reprieve, which says he has suffered severe physical and mental torture during his 14 years behind bars without charge or trial. One of his lawyers said, quote, "This is a landmark ruling. For 20 years, successive U.S. administrations have asserted their right to imprison people indefinitely without charge or trial. Guantanamo was built on the shakiest of legal foundations," they said. In Nigeria, demonstrators took to the streets Wednesday to mark 1 year since 2020's historic and deadly End SARS protests against police brutality. The march passed over the highway on the outskirts of Lagos, where last year soldiers and police opened fire on demonstrators. 12 protesters were killed that night. This is civil rights advocate Yemi Adamalekan speaking on Wednesday.
"Who ordered the shooting? Look, we're peaceful. Nothing is happening. All we want is justice. The police cannot continue to kill Nigerian citizens, and it will be okay. It can never be okay. That's all we are asking."
Back back in the United States, Republican Congressman Jeff Fortenberry of Nebraska stepped down from his House committee assignments Wednesday, one day after a federal grand jury in California indicted him for lying to FBI agents who were investigating alleged illegal contributions to his 2016 campaign. Fortenberry pleaded not guilty to the charges during an arraignment Wednesday and was released on $50,000 bond. And in Los Angeles, protesters gathered in front of the Netflix headquarters as a group of employees from the streaming giant staged a walkout Wednesday amidst the ongoing controversy over comedian Dave Chappelle's new special, The Closer, which features anti-trans jokes. In the stand-up show, Chappelle likens being trans to blackface and jokes about killing a woman. Trans employees have issued a list of demands to Netflix, including the recruitment of more trans workers into leadership roles, the creation of a fund to develop trans and non-binary talent, and the addition of disclaimers before transphobic and other hateful content. This is television personality David Huggard, also known as Eureka.
We as trans people and non-binary people aren't getting visibility or respect in the entertainment industry to begin with. And to have something like Dave Chappelle's special not be noted that it's promoting discrimination and hate conversation is very hurtful to the activism and the cause that we're trying to progress ourselves in the industry.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show looking at how key elements of President Biden's domestic agenda are in jeopardy. On Wednesday, Senate Republicans blocked passage of the Freedom to Vote Act. Not a single Republican supported the bill. Senate Democrats could pass the sweeping voting rights legislation, but only if they voted to end the filibuster. However, two conservative Democrats, Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, oppose doing so. Manchin and Sinema have also forced President Biden to radically scale back the Build Back Better Act, which began as a proposed $3.5 trillion spending bill over 10 years to vastly expand the social safety net and combat the climate crisis. Biden's reportedly lowered the top line price tag on the package to $1.75 trillion, half the original bill. Manchin wants the bill to be even smaller, pushing for $1.5 trillion over 10 years. Initiatives that could be dropped include free community college, extended paid family leave, and an initiative to lower prescription drug prices. Manchin's also demanded Democrats strip out funding for the Clean Electricity Performance Program, a critical climate initiative to replace coal and gas-fired power plants with renewable energy sources. Democrats are also moving away from proposals to increase the tax rate on the rich and corporations. On Wednesday, Mother Jones magazine reported Manchin's been privately telling associates he's considering leaving the Democratic Party and declaring himself a, quote, American independent if he doesn't get his way in slashing the size of the Build Back Better Act. Manchin rejected the report. We go now to Washington, where we're joined by Congressmember Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, who's been a vocal critic of Senator Manchin's efforts to obstruct passage of both the Build Back Better Act and the Freedom to Vote Act. After the voting rights bill failed in the Senate Wednesday, Congressmember Omar tweeted, "The filibuster and the Democratic senators who continue to uphold it are killing our democracy." Congressmember Ilhan Omar, welcome back to Democracy Now! You have to wonder at this point, when we talk about President Joe, if we're talking about President Joe Biden or President Joe Manchin. He is one senator, but holds so much power, though the $3.5 trillion spending, the $3.5 trillion spending bill, talking about scaling it back to $1.7 trillion, that's only a bit over the $1.5 trillion that this one senator has demanded. Can you talk about the significance of his power and also how it is related to him being the number one recipient of oil, gas, and coal money in the U.S. Senate?
Well, thank you so much, Amy, for having me. I think it is really important for people to understand the level of obstruction that this one senator is causing to the agenda of the president and everything we are trying to accomplish as Democrats on behalf of the American people. So for so long, people have said Washington is corrupt. They're not watching out for the interest of the people. And what's playing out right now with these senators really is giving people a front row seat to what they have always talked about. And we have to get past this. We have to be able to bring these senators on board. We have to be able to accomplish this agenda, because truly what is on the line? It's investment in childcare. It's investment in expanding paid family leave. It's an agenda to try to get vision, dental, and hearing paid for seniors, is trying to address the climate crisis so that there is something for the future generation. It's trying to do everything that we can so that people in our communities can feel the impact of their government. And as you said, all Democrats are essentially on board, except for these two who are essentially doing the bidding of big pharma, big oil, and Wall Street.
Representative Omar, how do you think that these senators, you said it's essential to bring them on board, what can Democrats do to persuade them to get on board?
We have to continue talking. This agenda is too big to fail. We've made these promises to the American people for a really long time. Investment in child care, paid family leave, in home and community-based care. These are things that are not just going to help particular communities, but it will help all communities across this country. And if we do not continue to have this conversation to move them along so that we can get it done, then we will not only fail to get our agenda done, but we would have failed the American people.
Congressmember Omar, I wanted to continue on this issue of Senator Manchin's power by talking about his business holdings in West Virginia. The Intercept recently published a report headlined Joe Manchin's Dirty Empire. It says, quote, for decades, Manchin has profited from a series of coal companies that he founded during the 1980s. His son, Joe Manchin IV, has since assumed leadership roles in the firms, and the senator says his ownership is held in a blind trust. Yet between the time he joined the Senate and today, Manchin has personally grossed more than $4.5 million from those firms, according to financial disclosures. He also holds stock options in EnerSystems, Inc., the larger of the two firms, valued between $1 and $5 million. So maybe this isn't a matter so much of ideology, but straightforward, the amount of money that he stands to make or lose based on this Build Back Better Act. He has demanded the stripping out of the section on renewable energy. Can you talk about this and if this is raised in dealing with him and what it would mean if he did leave the Democratic Party, or do you think it's an empty threat?
I think it is important for these connections to be made, and certainly for his constituents to recognize this. We have a representative democracy where you elect someone to represent your interest, not the interest of corporations and not their own interest. This, to me, sounds like legalized corruption. And if it was happening, anywhere else in the world, we would be appalled by it. But the fact that it continues to happen, not just with Manchin, but so many others, pegs the question, how are we going to continue to have the kind of democracy that we can be proud of and talk about transparency, accountability, and ending corruption to other parts of the world when we allow it to happen within our own country. you know, the devastation economically that is visible in West Virginia when you talk about all kinds of measures. It's the bottom of the 50 states almost always. And to have a senator that isn't focusing on creating the kind of investments that will uplift the communities that he represent is something that we need to seriously address.
So let's talk about what's in the act and what's not in the act, and what are lines in the sand, if you will. I mean, you've got the proposed cuts being cutting free community college for 2 years, cutting the Clean Electricity Performance Program, reducing paid family leave. Now, at the federal level, there isn't paid family leave, but it would go from 12 weeks to 4 weeks. Child tax credit, funding for home care. Can you talk about those that are now threatened, but also what remains, like universal pre-K, Medicare expansion, et cetera, and what you think is significant here, and how much power the Progressive Caucus has? You're the largest caucus in Congress.
So first of all, I just will say, you know, it's not done until it's done. Nothing has been agreed to by all parties, so I can't really say what is in and what is out at the moment. You know, we're obviously still negotiating. We're obviously still having these conversations. Some of the things that you'd mentioned would be some red lines for some of our members within the Progressive Caucus, and they have raised those concerns. And so we're still at the drawing board and trying to finalize a deal that can get the support of the Progressive Caucus and can have the support of these senators so that we are able to actually pass this piece of legislation. What we are arguing for is that, you know, four principles should be used by Congress in the final package. We want to make sure that there are transformative investments, that whatever piece of legislation we end up voting on touches people's lives immediately, that they provide universal benefits, and that they keep the president's commitment to racial equity. And so whether we end up cutting the duration of the investment or not, we will see. But right now, things are still up in the air and conversations are still taking place. So I wouldn't say this is out, this is in just yet.
Representative Umar, we'd like to move on now to the Freedom to Vote Act. On Wednesday, Senate Republicans blocked debate on the Freedom to Vote Act. And you tweeted in response, quote, "The filibuster and the Democratic senators who continue to uphold it are killing our democracy." Could you talk about what happened and elaborate on what you said?
Yeah, we know, obviously, that our democracy is under threat. And if we do not address the kind of challenges that are posed to our democracy with legislation, we are going to fail our democracy. And we're seeing Democrats in the Senate not understand that urgency. We have, you know, these two senators that are beholden more to this filibuster that is Senate procedure and not codified in our Constitution, that are willing to uphold that and not uphold the resiliency and health of our democracy so that it could continue to flourish.
And Representative Umar, another issue on which you've been vocal has to do with the increasing reports of what's being called modern day slavery in Libya, the widespread abuse of migrants in detention centers there. You wrote in a press statement, quote, "The U.S. needs a comprehensive strategy to address the ongoing human trafficking and modern day slavery crisis in Libya." Could you talk about what you know of what's happening and what strategy you're proposing the U.S. pursue?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. What's happening in Libya is truly heartbreaking. As someone who comes from one of the countries in Africa where people are being enslaved in Libya, I and so many others have, you know, personally been touched. We know family members, we know, you know, friends, we know people who are personally impacted in Libya. We have seen, you know, routine reports of rampant abuse, torture, sexual violence, extortion of migrants in Libya from sub-Saharan African countries. It is really painful that it is not getting the attention and response that it needs. And, you know, instead of welcoming thousands of refugees fleeing violence and instability, the Libyan coast guards hand migrants over to militias who systematically torture, rape, abuse, and enslave them. The European Union is making it worse by turning away migrants and instead arming these same militias that are committing these abuses. The United States hasn't had a comprehensive strategy to engage and to address this ongoing human trafficking crisis and this modern day slavery. I've met with representatives from United Nations orgs that are dealing with this situation. And what they're asking for is for the United States to step up, for us to help create a strategy and for us to have a conversation with the European Union, because, you know, what's taking place in Libya is a human rights crisis. It's a human tragedy. It's not something that we should allow to happen today. And it is something that needs the attention of the United States and other countries as well.
Two questions. One about vaccine equity in the world, what some call vaccine apartheid. As you heard in our headlines, you know, the FDA is quickly approving vaccines for children and also boosters to people as young as 40 years old. Can you talk about the issue of vaccine availability in the world, while the Western nations are massively vaccinating their populations, in some places, particularly the continent you come from Africa, we're looking at 1%, 2%, and 5% of the population vaccinated, not because of choice, but because they don't have access. While President Biden has supported the TRIPS waiver at the WTO, it's a question of expending political capital to force other countries like Germany and Britain, where the pharmaceutical companies are based that are making billions, do the same. Can you talk about what has to be done?
Yes. You're right. We do have to spend political capital on this. This is, you know, a catastrophe. Vaccine apartheid is real. There are so many people across the world who are celebrating, you know, 5%, 10%, 20% vaccination because that is the best that they can do with the limited resources that they have, while their wealthy counterparts are, you know, not doing their part and providing not just an overall vaccination, but even boosters, as you said, which is happening here in the United States and which will rapidly expand. Booster shots are not just going to be available for those, you know, who are at risk and older than 40. We're going to provide it to everyone soon. And we are even providing vaccinations to young children now when so many people around the world can't even vaccinate their most vulnerable members of their community. So, yes, it is the right thing for the United States to spend its political capital to say, let's come together as a world and address this pandemic that doesn't recognize boundaries and doesn't recognize that someone is wealthy and someone is poor. Everyone has suffered from it. And, you know, as you know, I've lost my father to COVID-19. There are so many people who have been tragically touched by this pandemic. And we are now at a moment where we can help those within our borders and extend that aid to others in different countries.
And our deep condolences again on the loss of your father. Do you think that the U.S. should be requiring Moderna to release its recipe, given how heavily subsidized, publicly subsidized their research was?
Yes, and I've said that from the start. But at this moment, Amy, you know, it is going to take a long time for that recipe to be utilized, and a lot of these countries don't have those resources. So what we're asking for is for the excess amounts that exist in some of the wealthiest countries, including ours here in the United States, to be donated, and for that transfer to happen in an urgent matter to every corner of the world.
Finally, Congressmember Omar, you're calling on President Biden to intervene in the construction of the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline in your state in northern Minnesota and to protect indigenous sovereignty and the environment. And this last week, more than 600 people, overwhelmingly indigenous, were arrested in Washington, D.C. in this Native American-led climate protest. You also have the Guardian newspaper revealing that Enbridge paid Minnesota police $2.4 million in reimbursements, all costs tied to arrests and surveillance of hundreds of water protectors. Can you talk about this and what needs to happen now?
The president has to intervene. I have called on the president to intervene to stop this pipeline. Just yesterday, the president addressed our boundary waters and talked about tribal sovereignty and treaty rights. And it was astonishing, really, to hear these statements coming in regards to the wilderness and the boundary waters, when we are not using a similar statement in regards to Line 3 and what it means for the northern Minnesota and our indigenous brothers and sisters. And what it means for their tribal sovereignty, what it means for the treaty rights, which are supreme laws in this land, and what it means for their livelihood, what it means in regards to their wildlife. I mean, the Anishinaabe communities in Minnesota say, you know, it is their culture that they were told to go where food grows on water, and wild rice is their life. It's their culture. It's their tradition. It's basically their existence. And we don't have this president addressing the urgency of stopping this pipeline that will essentially destroy their land and ultimately pollute everybody that has access to the Mississippi.
Well, Congressmember Ilhan Omar, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Minnesota Congressmember representing the 5th Congressional District. Her memoir is titled, This is What America Looks Like, My Journey from Refugee to Congresswoman. You can go to democracynow.org to see our extended interview with Congressmember Omar about her memoir. And a quick correction in our Guantanamo Bay headline. Asadullah Harun Gul is the first prisoner in 10 years, not 2 years, to win a habeas corpus argument. He is the Guantanamo prisoner. Next up, we look at Senator Joe Manchin's dirty empire in West Virginia. Stay with us.
Joe.
Johnny Sunshine by Liz Phair. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we turn now to look at Joe Manchin's dirty empire. That's the headline of a recent investigation by The Intercept into Manchin's business holdings in West Virginia. Reporter Daniel Bogoslaw examines how Manchin's profited from a series of coal companies that he founded during the 80s. His son, Joe Manchin IV, now runs the companies, but Senator Manchin continues to earn millions from the firms. Manchin is now demanding Democrats strip funding for the Clean Electricity Performance Program, a critical climate initiative to replace coal and gas-fired plants with renewable energy sources. Investigative journalist Daniel Bogoslaw filed this story with support from Type Investigations and joins us now from Portland, Oregon. Lay out for us, Daniel Bogoslaw. On the one hand, you have Senator Manchin, the largest recipient of oil, gas, coal money in the Senate. But what isn't talked as much about is that he is making millions off his own companies in West Virginia, even if some of that money is now in a blind trust. Lay out the empire.
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me. In the late 80s, Manchin basically started a coal brokerage firm. He was the middleman between suppliers and buyers. And from that time, he built out the empire, essentially brokering coal between all these plants. Today, that's largely focused on the Granttown power plant, which at one point he became the main supplier of. The biggest issue to understand here is the way that that impacts the air, the soil, and the water of West Virginia, the way that the coal that he's supplying ends up impacting the environment across all these dimensions and impacting constituents in a number of ways.
And Daniel, you talk in the piece about how during the Obama administration, Manchin was one of the loudest voices opposing the Obama era's EPA rules limiting mercury and aerosolized acid emissions. But then subsequently, he reversed his position under the Trump administration. Could you explain what happened?
Sure. So effectively, these rules were seeking to limit and impose regulations on the way coal-fired power plants could release mercury and also sulfur dioxide acid gas. This would have created a requirement for these plants to use expensive scrubbing technology. And so the industry was opposed to anything that could potentially cut into their profits. Once those technologies were already installed, these suppliers were able to increase their rates, which were passed on to consumers. And so during the Trump years, when parts of the industry were looking at overturning these regulations, these companies had already incorporated the costs into their rates. And so removing them could have also forced them to lower the rates they were able to charge, having already suffered a loss from installing this technology. And so Manchin went from decrying regulation of these extremely dangerous production facilities to turning around and saying that mercury is extremely dangerous for children, and effectively doing a complete 180.
And in this final question, can you talk about the extent to which he and his family, his brothers, his son, have profited so enormously to this day to continuation of the coal industry, even though he recognizes it's a dying industry?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think what you're seeing is prioritizing a dying industry that he's making millions of dollars off of. While on the table in Biden's package, we're seeing all of these incentives to completely modernize that industry, to invest in clean energy technologies. Unfortunately, that's not Manchin's business. His business is coal. And I think we're going to continue to see that be prioritized as these negotiations continue.
Well, Daniel Bogislaw, we're going to continue to look at this issue. Investigative reporter, New Intercept story will link to Joe Manchin's dirty empire. Next up, we go to Egypt to look at the case of the imprisoned activist and blogger Ala Abdel Fattah, who spent much of the past decade locked up. Stay with us. Karshid. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we turn now to Egypt. The Biden administration said it'll withhold 10% or $130 million in military aid to Egypt amidst mounting concerns over human rights abuses by President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's government. This means nearly $1.2 billion in military assistance will continue to flow to Egypt, even as a new report by Human Rights Watch finds Egyptian Interior Ministry forces have killed perhaps hundreds of secretly held dissidents in extrajudicial executions in recent years. It's estimated Egypt holds about 60,000 political prisoners. This comes as prominent Egyptian activist and blogger Ala Abdel Fattah appeared before the Emergency State Security Court in Cairo Monday to face charges of spreading false news on social media and belonging to terrorist groups. He's charged along with his lawyer, Mohamed El-Bakr, and another blogger, Mohamed Ibrahim, known as Mohamed Oxygen. Abdel Fattah was imprisoned after his arrest in September 2019 following a rare protest over revelations that President Sisi used public funds to buy for lavish palaces for himself. On Monday, Abdel Fattah's trial was adjourned until November 1st, meaning he will be held even longer after 2 years of pre-trial detention. His 2019 arrest came just 6 months after he was released from prison after serving a five-year term for his role in the peaceful Egyptian revolution in 2011. We want to turn right now to 2011. This was after he was first arrested and ordered jail by a military court, then briefly released before being imprisoned again.
I'm very optimistic about our chances, but it's very difficult to predict when we're going to make more wins or and so on. I think it's going to be a lengthy process. I think the price is going to be very high. The recent crackdowns that happened like in the past few weeks, there's a sense that they're now targeting people, that the killings are not random anymore, that they're picking who to kill. The intensity of the torture is much higher. I think the whole world have seen how they try to use sexual violence, specifically against women and in public, to strike some fear into us. So what comes next might be even tougher and even more difficult. But I don't think that this revolution is going to end without really completely renegotiating the order of power in Egypt.
Let's talk about one of
the Arab world.
That was Ala Abdel Fattah speaking to Democracy Now! In 2011 before he was sent back to prison. This week, a collection of his prison writings, interviews, and articles was released titled, "You Have Not Yet Been Defeated." For more, we're going to Cairo, Egypt, where we're joined by Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdelkaddous, who is a correspondent and reporter from Adamasser, based in Cairo, and by Ala Abdel Fattah's mother, Leila Swaif, who is a mathematics professor at Cairo University. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Professor Swaif, let's begin with you. When did you last see your son? Talk about what happened in court on Monday and the significance of, while he is in prison, his writings being released.
Well, I last saw Ala on Monday in court, and we had a chance to see him. He had a chance to talk to the judge about the conditions of his incarceration. He's been in jail on pre-trial remand for more than 2 years, which is completely illegal. Also, for these whole 2 years, he has not been allowed anything to read, absolutely anything, not even an official newspaper. And he's not been allowed exercise time. So he's locked up in his cell without any means of passing the time. And he only gets out of his cell if he's got a family visit, which are now, because of Corona, only once a month. And if he's got a hearing at the state prosecutor or in court. So he talked about that, and he also talked about the fact that the prosecution is claiming that he made false claims about someone who died in jail in the same prison where Ala is, and that he accused these same officers who now have power over Ala. So yeah, he said that this is completely irresponsible of the prosecution to put him in this position, and that he wanted to sue them. The judge listened. He also listened to Baqir and Muhammad, who asked to be released and said that they had not been spreading false news, etc. And then he remanded them in custody until the 1st of November, and he only allowed the lawyers to look at the files. He did not give permission for the lawyers to photocopy the files, which is really...
Professor Leila Swaif has just frozen for a minute, her video Skype right now in Egypt. But she's back. Nermeen?
Professor Swaif, could you also talk about, you mentioned that now because of COVID restrictions, Ala is only able to have one visit a month, which is reportedly only 20 minutes long. Can you explain the conditions under which those visits are held, and also the significance of him being held at this prison, the Thora prison?
Yes. Ala is held in the high security 2 prison in Thora, which is, and the only prison that is worse than that is high security 1, where they put people away and don't even allow them visits. They don't allow them anything at all. Okay? So, high security 2 is just a little bit better in that we are allowed visits, but our visits are in a sort of glass cabin, and we talk through a mouthpiece, and of course everything we say to each other is recorded, I assume, Yanya. And I can't hug him, I can't touch him, and the visit is, now because of COVID restrictions, it's once a month for 20 minutes for one family member only. Before COVID restrictions, we got an hour every week, and three family members were allowed to enter. Now, anyone who lives in Egypt knows that there are no more COVID restrictions or anything. I've been teaching at the university. The lectures are no longer online. There are no more COVID restrictions on anything except the prisons. You can draw your own conclusions from that.
Mm. And Sharif, if you could talk about the broader context in which Ala's arrest and imprisonment is taking place. Ala, as well as his sister Sana, are one among, as we mentioned in our introduction, 60,000 political prisoners in Egypt. So could you talk about the way in which these people are being detained, the fact that they all seem to be, or many of them seem to be, accused of the same things, spreading false rumors, being involved with terrorist groups, etc. Sharif.
Yeah, the vast majority of political prisoners in Egypt have not been convicted of a crime. They're being held in pretrial detention. We've heard about Ala, Mohamed Oxygen, Mohamed Al-Bakr. There's so many others. Marwa Arafa, Khulud Saeed, Rami Shah, Ziad Al-Alemi, Hashem Mo'nes. All of these people are being held in pretrial detention, which gets renewed every 15 days or 45 days. And often what happens after the legal two-year limit, people who cross that, for example, Abdelmenem Abu Futuh, who is a former presidential candidate, they just lodge a new case against you. It restarts the clock. It's called tadwir, or rotation, and you re-enter this labyrinth of pretrial detention for another 2 years. And they are, almost everyone is charged under the anti-terror law with these two identical charges, which is publishing false news or belonging to an outlawed group or terrorist organization. And so we've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of people being held in this way. What happened on Monday, Ala and Bakr and Oxygen, their two-year limit expired sometime in late September. They were currently being held illegally, even by Egypt's own penal code, in pretrial detention. And then we found out just last week that they had been transferred to trial in this emergency state security court, which this court's rulings cannot be appealed. So whatever sentence is handed down, the only way to challenge them, there isn't a way to challenge them actually legally. There has to be amnesty by the president or a pardon or something like that. And this comes in a larger context of a crackdown on kind of any and all voices who speak out. And we've seen a crackdown on the media, a crackdown on doctors who speak out against how the government is dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, and much, much more. And I just have to say also that in the last few months, Ala has been experiencing increasing restrictions and increasingly harsh conditions. They have emptied the cells around him to isolate him. When he's transferred to any judicial proceeding, he is not taken with other prisoners in the regular prisoner transport truck. They take him alone in an armored personnel carrier. And this has begun to have a very deep effect on him. He's slipping into despair. His sister, Mona, who had the last visit with him before the court trial on Monday, so this was just last week, she asked him about his physical health because she saw that his hands were pale and shaking. And he apparently exploded at her and said, "Stop asking about my health. Stop being concerned with my physical health, just like them. The problem is I'm physically well. I eat, I defecate, I sleep, and I just do the same thing every day. But as long as I have nothing for my mind, nothing that works here," and he pointed to his head, "I won't survive this place." He said, "I wish that I were not well. I wish something would happen to my body so I die and put an end to all of this." So this is the kind of despair Ala is being driven to. He's in prison because of his mind, and they're trying to destroy it.
Sharif, at the same time, you have this incredible collection of essays of Al-Fata, prison writings, interviews, articles called "You Have Not Yet Been Defeated." Naomi Klein wrote a beautiful foreword that begins, "The text you are holding is living history." Sharif, could you read a bit, since Allah is imprisoned from his own work?
Okay, I'll read something from, this is a piece titled A Portrait of the Activist Outside His Prison. It was written from Torah Prison in March of 2017 and first published at Mada Masr. It focuses on the importance of meaning. I'll just read the last two, I'll read this part. It's over. We have been defeated and meaning has been defeated with us. And just as we were, in every step, affected by the world and affecting it, so was our defeat both a symptom and a cause of a wider war on meaning. A war on the crime of people searching for a supranational public sphere, where they might find intimacy, exchange, communication, even quarrels that allow a common understanding of reality and multiple dreams of alternative worlds. I'm in prison because the regime wants to make an example of us. So let us be an example, but of our own choosing. The war on meaning is not yet over in the rest of the world. Let us be an example, not a warning. Let's communicate with the world again, not to send distress signals, nor to cry over ruins or spilled milk, but to draw lessons, summarize experiences, and deepen observations may it help those struggling in the post-truth era. Siding with the stronger party is generally not useful. The powerful need nothing from you but to parrot their propaganda. The weak often cause as much trouble as they suffer. Their arguments and discourses are often as brittle as their positions in society and their diminishing chances of safety and survival. Taking their side, therefore, even as an experiment, stimulates deeper reflection, investigation, analysis, and imagination. We were. Then we were defeated, and meaning was defeated with us. But we have not perished yet, and meaning has not been killed. Perhaps our defeat was inevitable, but the current chaos that is sweeping the world will sooner or later give birth to a new world, a world that will, of course, be ruled and managed by the victors. But nothing will constrain the strong, nor shape the margins of freedom and justice, nor define spaces of beauty and possibilities for a common life, except the weak, who clung to their defense of meaning even after defeat. So again, that was written in 2017 from Torah Prison.
Thank you, Sharif. Given the situation of Allah, as well as tens of thousands of others, the Biden administration said earlier in September that it would cut just 10% or condition 10% of its annual military aid. That is $130 million out of $1.3 billion on certain conditions that the Sisi government fulfill with respect to human rights abuses in Egypt. Do you know what some of those conditions are, specifically having to do with prosecutions in case 173? Could you explain what that is?
And we just have 30 seconds, Sharif.
It's unclear, but according to the Washington Post, the human rights conditions, and they spoke to unnamed officials, said it include ending this decades-long prosecution of the leading human rights NGOs in Egypt, as well as dropping charges or releasing 16 individuals. We do not know the names of these individuals or their identities as they remain classified.
We're going to leave it there, but if you can both stay on, we're going to do a part two of this conversation. We've been speaking with Sharif El-Quddous, Democracy Now! Correspondent in Cairo, and Mada Masr, reporter, and Leila Swef, professor of mathematics at Cairo University, mother of jailed activist Ala Abdel Fattah. Happy birthday to Robbie Caron. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.